your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, last minute change. I mentioned last week that today I was looking forward to interviewing a guy who wrote a book called Everyday Millionaires and How You Can Do It Too and all of that. But last second, he canceled, rescheduled, whatever. So I said, oh, now what in the world am I going to do? So I pulled out my trusty backup person, Dr. Barbara Nemko, my wife and the Napa County Superintendent of Schools. I just happened to notice, by the way, there was a plaque on our wall. I noticed it said she was Superintendent of the Year not that long ago. And I keep forgetting to mention that. So I thought I would give her that honorific. Barbara Nemko, thank you for being an excellent pinch hitter available on short notice.
I was going to say, excuse me, I'm second best, and then you throw that in, and so I'm sure your listeners are saying, give me a break.
Well, I'm sure you're going to punish me for the rest of the hour for that faux pas. In any case, what we thought might be a balance of both entertainment and as well as instructional value regarding your career, or your child's career, grandchild's career, whatever, is for us to tell our career story. We all have signature moments from when we were a child all the way to today that were important in our career and may offer some lessons learned. And so to try to compensate for my faux pas, I will be a traditional, classic, atavistic gentleman and say, ladies first. And Barbara, would you care to tell me your, essentially your work, the signature moments in your work history from when you were a kid?
Well, obviously, when I was a kid, I didn't have a work history.
You know what I mean.
I didn't have work, but I had thoughts about work.
Yeah.
Because every aunt and uncle always grabs your cheeks and pinches them and say, oh my God, you got so big, and what are you going to be when you grow up?
Right.
And not being too sophisticated, my first career ambition when I was living in the Bronx, and granted, we moved when I was 6 or 7, I wanted to be a nun.
Why?
Because I would see, remember in those days, all nuns wore full habits.
Right.
And I would see them walking through the neighborhood. And they got so much respect from the people that they passed on the street that it seemed like it was a very admirable thing to do. Granted, A, I had no idea what being a nun meant. I liked the outfit. What can I say?
You still like costumes, right?
It was a fashion statement that was different. And I wanted to be respected. I, even at a young age, could tell that was important. And so that's what I wanted to be. I was quickly disabused of the notion when I discovered I was Jewish and nuns were not. So I wasn't a likely candidate to be too successful in that particular career.
Well, I thought that the Catholic Church had become ecumenical in the 60s, and they might have welcomed a Jewish nun for diversity.
They might have, but when I was 5 years old, it wasn't in the 60s.
Okay,
so,
right.
You know, I miss that whole thing. A lot of what I'm going to talk about is really related to the norms of the time, because it's so different today. So once I realized I wasn't going to be a nun, my mother basically laid out what the choices were for a girl who grew up in the 50s. And that was, you could be a teacher, you could be a nurse, or you could be a librarian. Nobody thought about women going to law school or medical school or veterinary school. It was unheard of. In fact, women weren't even going to college. So my mother looked through her lens and saw these careers for women. She quickly eliminated nurse because she said, no daughter of mine is going to be cleaning bedpans, which left me with teacher and librarian. Well, librarian seemed rather tame and boring from what I knew of librarians, which was you would take out a book and you would bring it to the counter and they would have a pencil with a stamp on the other end. And they would hit the stamp pad and stamp your book with the date that it was due. And I thought that was pretty cool, but didn't seem like a lifetime job. So teacher it was. And I knew from a very young age that that was what I was going to be.
Okay, and so what was the next signature moment in your work history?
When I got to Queens College, and I was pretty young, but my mother worked there. So she was able to get me a job for, are you ready, da-da-da-da, drum roll please, 85 cents an hour. And for 85 cents an hour, I was working in the registrar's office. I would answer the telephone, registrar's office, may I help you? and they would ask me a question, and I should have been saying, registrar's office, may I transfer you? Because I didn't know any answers to anything. So I had to learn who knew what and where to transfer the calls.
Of course, what's interesting is that, as always, it's who you know. You didn't apply for the job through the official personnel office, I guess it was what it was called back then. Your mother got you the job.
Correct.
Okay, continue. Next signature
moment.
That
was a lesson learned. But the other part of the job was pretty much, if I wasn't answering the phone, the other thing I was doing was writing address labels to put on catalogs for the people who would call in and ask to be mailed the Queen's College catalog. Mm. And even at the tender age of 16 and 17, which is what I was at that point, I knew this was not a very high-level job.
You know, so I want to stop a minute. I just had to, you know, I flashed when I was of that age. Right now, I'm so aware that the college catalog and the college website are just like brochures, they're sales tools. But it meant so much to me to get the catalog from Columbia University. It felt, you know, and the pictures, even though they were black and white. I don't think we as adults realize how impressionable young people are based on crap. Anyway, but I digress. Go ahead.
So I had a certain hubris and thought, I'm smarter than this to be writing people's names and addresses on the label that I'm putting on the catalog. I should be doing more, but they were not about to let me do any more. But then I learned something that really is very important. Because I worked there, I had the privilege of being able to register for classes first. Had all the people who worked there, you could register first. Mm. And this was in the days when you were not registering online.
Right.
Online did not exist.
Right.
But you had to walk into a gymnasium that was filled with tables.
Right.
And at each table was a person, and the person had a certain number of courses in front of them. And if there was room in the class and you registered, they would hand you a physical course card, an IBM punch card.
I remember that. Go ahead.
So imagine, because it was first come, first serve, that when they opened registration to seniors first, then juniors, then sophomores, then freshmen, it was a madhouse. It was a stampede. I can still remember the doors being locked and all of us who were working going inside, and then they would do a countdown and then open the doors, and people would race over to the tables of the most popular classes in order to get the class or the instructor or the time that they wanted or all three. And the lines were huge. So as a freshman, sophomore, you knew you weren't going to get anything that you wanted, and you were going to end up with a schedule where you might have an 8 o'clock class on Monday, and the next class might be 3 in the afternoon on Monday, followed by a 2 o'clock class on Tuesday. You'd have a really messed up schedule.
This seems to have pretty minimal impact on career implications.
No, here, I'll give you the career implications.
Okay, all right.
The implication was that the perk of that job, that I could register first, and I could have any courses I want because nobody had registered, so there were always the cards available. I could develop my schedule exactly the way I wanted it. I could go to school from 9 to 1, 4 days a week, and that would be it. And then I could go home and do my homework or whatever else I wanted to do. But it wasn't the 85 cents that kept me doing that stupid job, which bored me terribly. It was the perk of being able to register. So I learned that it's not necessarily the salary, it's what benefits go along with it.
And sometimes that's a little anomalous situation, but always, I've had a number of people who are graduates of Stanford who end up taking a job as a receptionist at a prestigious place, a receptionist at I had one at KGO Radio, I had one at Genentech, and when you're a receptionist, you have access.
Mm-hmm.
You have access to all the people. And if you're sounding smart and responsible, and to be really honest, flirtatious, unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of people who complain about sex in the workplace, but there's a lot of people who have gotten ahead because of their flirtatiousness in the workplace. And you get the kind of access to a place like, you know, like Apple or Google or Facebook, when you're inside, even if you're a receptionist, that you could never get, including if you were working remotely for one of those companies. What's the next signature moment in your work life? Well, let's let our listeners know what you're listening to. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We are talking about lessons learned from our own career experiences. We're going chronologically, starting with Barbara, and walking through and lessons that were learned from her own career experiences. Then I'm going to do mine, and in between that, we're going to invite you to call in and, if you wish, to share your career history. But I want to go all the way through Barbara's first, and then we will invite you to call in. Barbara, continue.
Okay, then I got my first real job, which was teaching second grade at Public School 13 in Elmhurst, Queens. And I discovered that people will ask you to do things that you may know nothing about, and it doesn't matter that you don't know anything about the thing that they're asking you to do, they'll teach you. And what's most important is that you are a team player and willing to take it on.
Well, so, that's changed now.
Brand new teacher. I'm 19 years old. And the school secretary comes over to me in the first, 3 months of my employment there. And she says, tell me, do you have a checking account? I was still living at home. I was a kid. I said, no. She said, do you know what a double entry bookkeeping system is? No, I have no idea. I'd never taken a bookkeeping class. She said, congratulations, you're the new school treasurer.
Wow. So, but the reason I was interrupting you when you said they'll train you, that's where the world has changed so much. Because employers can so easily place an ad on Indeed, on Craigslist, on LinkedIn, they get hundreds of applicants who can hit the ground running. So training has really gone by the boards, except for fast-track people who they've already hired, have shown excellent performance on the job, and then they may train them so they can move ahead. And they're even cutting back on what they used to do, which they used to offer tuition reimbursement. They figured, hey, why should we provide the training in-house? Well, give them a few $1,000 and they can go to the local university. But the university has not exactly turned out a product that employers are very happy with. They end up turning out employees who hate corporate America. And so they say, what the hell are we doing paying for that? So they're doing more training in-house, but only for the fast-track people. But in terms of getting hired, don't expect to get trained on the job. Unfortunately, you got to come in with the training. And the problem with that is it's catch-22. If you have no training, you can't get hired. And if you've got the training, then how are you going to get the training if you don't get the job? In the university training, employers are rolling the eyes at degrees now. They're not only ubiquitous, but ever more theoretical and ever more anti-employer. So anyway, please continue.
Well, all of that is true. Those are all good points.
Thank you.
My point was not that I was trained for the job of teaching. They weren't training me. They expected that I had that when I came in. It was that even though I had zero experience, they could have asked a more experienced teacher to do it. They only asked me because I was the rookie. Had I said I refuse to do this because I don't know anything about it, I would have been on the bad list for years, all the years I was at that school. But I said, well, if you'll teach me how to do it, I'm sure I can learn what a double-entry bookkeeping system is. And, thereupon probably messed up their books. There were only two entries, the lunch money and the milk money. And it was quite a challenge for me since I'd never done that before.
I got to say, I've had a number of clients who meet, say, 75% of the requirements in a job ad. And they go and we go over the job ad requirements. And they tell me, oh, I could learn that on the job. I say, if you're going to say that, that's going to, unfortunately, in the old days that might have worked. But now that scene is just not, it's just not
right.
Viable.
This was not part of my job.
I know. You say, okay.
Okay.
Next thing.
When I graduated, oh my God. So now I taught and went to different schools and did lots of things. And then moving to California and ending up going to UC Berkeley. Here, really important one. When we first moved to California, and it was in the 70s, and they were not hiring teachers. It was part of the recession, the economy was bad, and everybody said, you're crazy, you're giving up a tenured New York job, and you're going to California, you'll never get a job. And if I had listened to that, probably I never would have gotten a job. But you wisely said to me, get in the car, we're going to drive around, you're going to walk into all of these school districts and walk into the personnel office and introduce yourself and give them your resume and see if they have any positions available. And that's what we did. And in, I don't know, how long did it take? A week? A week and a half?
Well,
I got offered a couple of jobs.
You got three jobs in 5 days. The real takeaway, though, is one size doesn't fit all. Barbara's very personable, and she thinks on her feet. She looks great. So she's the kind of person, and she's not shy. So she can pull that off. Don't think that, you know, I don't want to overgeneralize. There are some people who are very shy who make a better impression doing a written application, who, you know, who are going to do better on the phone. Yes, eventually you get an in-person interview. But this kind of walking in, first of all, of course, in today's era of security consciousness, most workplaces have, you know, security guards, and you can't get in unless you, you know, you are employed there. So, you know, I don't want to overgeneralize. But if you are somebody who is very prepossessing, verbally as well as visually, unfortunately, in a lookist world, and you're looking at small places of employment that don't have a phalanx of security guards there, then walking in still can still work. Okay, continue, Barb.
I think the other thing that's pretty important, and again, this goes back to expectations. Number one, when we grew up, it was not the era of everybody must have great self-esteem. Today's kids are told you can be anything you want to be. We weren't told that. We were told these are your choices. And our choices were limited by our parents' vision of what the world was. And if you had parents who had a rather limited vision as I did, no one ever suggested that I could rise to any great heights. Today they tell all kids, oh my God, you can be anything. Dream big. No one ever told me the dream. And two, there was no way to find out about all these jobs. Even television was a pretty limited medium at that time, with three channels and not a whole lot of programs. So the kinds of things that we watched on television, I Love Lucy, so she was a housewife and he was a Cuban band leader. There wasn't a lot there that was going to give me an idea of what job I might want.
You could have worked on the donut conveyor line.
Candy
conveyor line. Right.
I could stuff my bra as well as they did.
Right.
But today, there are all these very specific websites. You can log on to the California Career Zone, and you can start figuring out when you're in elementary school what kinds of jobs you might want to do or what characteristics you have that might match up with certain types of jobs. And you see a much wider array of people doing jobs available every day on television. You see lawyers and doctors, and it's not terribly realistic, but it at least makes kids think, maybe I want to be an emergency room doctor, or I want to be an attorney, or whatever the jobs are that they're looking at, which we didn't have either.
I want to make a brief comment about the self-esteem thing. I didn't realize until I read some article maybe a decade ago in which some of the most successful people on earth, from Abraham Lincoln to leading scientists, were plagued by low self-esteem. And when I think about it, it makes sense. If you're complacent and you think you're hot stuff, you don't have this fear driving you to be better. Now, I'm not saying paralyzing fear, but if there is this fear you're not good enough, that's going to drive you to work harder. And I have to say, speaking for myself, I'm always worried. I am worried before every radio show, am I going to be good enough? And that drives me to work harder. Before every client, I would never dream of not preparing for a client. Now I can wing it. No. And so I think I'm worrying whether the self-esteem movement ultimately leads to more complacency than competency.
I think either thing to an extreme is not good.
Right.
Yes, the kids who think that they are the greatest things ever born and that the world owes them something, that's not a favor that people do to their kids. But what I had, which was no aspirations, no one telling me, well, you're smart, you could do this or that, held me back a lot.
Okay, next signature moment. Let's let our listeners know again. Listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, we are telling, we're starting with Barbara's career signature moments from childhood through today, and extracting lessons learned that may be relevant to you or your children or your grandchildren regarding work life. Okay, we should probably just come up with one or two more really important signature events, and let's go to the phones and invite our listeners to call.
Persistence. After doing graduate school at Cal, there was a job that was available at UC Davis evaluating school programs. And I called to find out about that. We were living in Oakland or Berkeley at the time, and UC Davis was a 69-mile commute one way. So I called and asked if the job required the evaluator to be at UC Davis in the office 5 days a week, and the answer was yes. And I said, okay, well, thanks so much, because I couldn't imagine commuting 140 miles every single day. And then a few months later, I thought about it, and I thought, well, what if I could do some data work for them over the summer, because that's what I was trained to do. So I wrote a letter, and I said, I called about this job, and I was not able to be there 5 days a week, but over the summer, I'd love to do some data analysis for you. And I ended up getting a call from the person running the program saying, well, you know, we had hired somebody, and she had to leave because she was pregnant, and we figured out we could get somebody to share the job with you, and if you'd like to do it 3 days a week, that would work. And so just because I didn't give up but tried a different avenue, I ended up at getting that job and then staying there for 11 years.
For what it's worth, just to show that we're not oblivious to, I mean, I can tell you the respect I have for the number of clients who have applied for 50 jobs, 100 jobs, 150 jobs, and didn't give up. I think, you know, you didn't have the series of rejections that is unfortunately so ubiquitous among people. Okay, tell us one more. Take your time. Think of one more signature event in your work-life history that may offer a lesson for all of us.
Well, I thought I was the shyest person on the planet and was more afraid, like most people are, of public speaking than of dying. And I ended up meeting a group of ladies who worked in health careers, and they invited me, or I was working with them on evaluation, and they asked me to talk to a group of people that they were working with. And I discovered that I liked it. I wasn't so terrified. When I actually tried speaking, I got a nice reaction from them. And that started me on a whole new avenue, not a new career, but doing a tremendous amount of public speaking in my career. And the more you do it, that communication skill is wildly important for moving up the career ladder.
Of course, not everybody is meant to be a public speaker. Some people are verbal and think quickly on your feet. You've always been able to do that. You just were afraid of the audience, afraid of doing it in front of a group, and then it was simply a matter of desensitization. But again, wanting to be responsive to my larger audience here, I think the key to whether it's worth remediating that, quote, weakness or fear of public speaking is asking yourself, how well do you think on your feet? Because you can't script. If you script things or even paraphrase, you're going to be too, the chemistry will be gone, it'll be bad, no matter how much you use PowerPoint. So the people who perhaps don't have any experience or limited experience in public speaking, but who nonetheless in conversation are able to think quickly on their feet, they might do something like join Toastmasters or do some self-study on their own and maybe do in front of their own webcam, give little one-minute talks, two-minute talks, and do it sequentially at work. Don't start by asking to give a talk, but at a staff meeting, speak up for more than yes or no. Give a 1 or 2 minute report and keep learning from that. Ask for feedback. So I think that's the takeaway there. Yes?
I think everybody should develop the ability to speak well, clearly, in public.
And nice. And ideally, it would be nice. I don't think everybody.
I mean, obviously, unless you have some phobia about it, or you really can't.
Not everybody's that verbal.
It's very helpful.
The same way as I can't fix anything, and you know, telling me, you know, everybody should learn how to fix things around the house. It's not a good use of my time. Similarly, some people are really bad at thinking on their feet. I had a client today, who's a very bright guy, But he's just very reflective. He's an analyst, and he likes to think things through. He's relentless in digging up details. But you ask, you know, I'm talking to him, and there's this what I call long latency. I will ask him a question, and there'll be 3 seconds go by, 4 seconds, and then he starts to talk slowly. You know, not everybody's meant to be a public speaker. Period.
I'm not talking about public speaking. You do need to be able to speak, whether you're speaking in the meeting or you're speaking with a colleague. It is, I think, a helpful skill to learn.
All right. You got anything more? Should we go to the food?
Nope.
Okay.
Done.
All right. You're listening to Work with Marty Ancona, Barbara Nemco. We're telling our career stories. We told Barbara's first with me doing my various interjections, and I'm going to tell mine in a few minutes, but I want to prioritize you, my dear listeners. We used Barbara's story first to kind of give you a sense of the kind of things that we think are instructive and interesting. If you would like to tell a few, you don't have to tell 8 or 9 things, you know, 2 or 3 signature moments in your career history, vivid memories, instructive experiences, whatever, in your own work life, whether it be as an early thing as a child or in college or in your young adulthood, or if you're older than a young adult, your story could be at any age. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, if you would like to share your story, we will interject and ask you questions, make comments and stuff. The phone number, 415-841-4134. What is that, the number for? KALW, and Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. 415-841-4134. All right. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, I'm going to start doing mine, and you can feel free, Barbara, to interject and make comments, criticisms, ask questions about the signature moments that I have had in my work life. And I'm going to, like you, I'm going to start as a child. I was probably 8, and my father and mother had a few friends over, and I remember him suddenly turning to me. I was just like this bump on the log there. And he suddenly simply said to me something like, this is a paraphrase, but I was 8, and he says, Martin, work. That's what's important. Anybody can have fun. Doesn't help anybody. Work. That's what matters. And for some reason, although that was lecturing, condescending, and pontificating, and I was 8 or 9 years old, that stuck. God knows why. Next signature moment. My first job, I don't think it was my first. It was somewhere, it was like 15 or 16 or something like that. I got some kind of a job in the summer after I was in high school or whatever, in which I had a job in an office. And I was told the first day to show up at 9 o'clock, and I was right there at 9. And I come in there, and I'm seeing people with their feet up on their desks reading the newspaper. And I say, oh, maybe they, you know, it's the unusual day, or they start a couple of 9:15. They're reading the newspaper. They're chatting with each other. I didn't want to speak up. I, you know, I'm a little pipsqueak. What the hell? Who the hell am I? But 9:30, they're still doing it. And finally, one of them starts to maybe, I don't remember, sigh or whatever. And I said, is there, so I announced myself when I came in at 9. I didn't want to interrupt. Is there some work you want me to do? Okay. It got me into the real world of not the school books about work that you read about, you know, Mr. Jones went to the office and he started working. It got me an introduction. Not all workplaces are like this, but some workplaces really are not. They're semi-workplaces. And that, for some reason, that stuck. I was repulsed by it. Something about the fact that they were getting paid and they were sitting and reading the newspaper. Anyway, that was my next memory.
Hmm.
Third memory was in college. I was a cab driver, New York City taxi cab driver. And I've had a number of careers, and I look back on all of them, including, and they were all more prestigious than that. Cab driving was my very favorite job. And that reminded me of how sometimes status and prestige is the enemy of contentment. Because I could succeed with every single passenger, and I surprised them because I was more verbal than the average, and yet if there were a couple in intimate conversation in the back, I didn't interrupt. I drove quite quickly but safely. I never took them the long route to make more money, you know. And so I was getting big tips. I get every satisfied customer. Food oriented, unfortunately, that I am. I could double park in Manhattan and stop in front of the best pizza bite to slice places. And so, of all my careers, including some very prestigious ones, if somebody put a gun to my head and said, which was my favorite, it was cab driving in New York.
And that was just because,
as I said,
people were so interesting?
Succeeding with every client. I surprised them with my abilities, that I was verbal, if I really unusually verbal, if I needed to be, or quiet, very respectful, that I just did the job really well. So every passenger was impressed. And it feels good to be good at anything, even if it's something small and unprestigious like cab driver. That was my takeaway.
Okay.
Then I, while driving the cab, my girlfriend Ruthie had told me about the most prestigious university nobody's ever heard of, called the Rockefeller University. And so that night when I was on my shift, I did the night shift, I would drive around the four blocks of the Rockefeller University in New York, hoping somebody from the Rockefeller would hail me, hail my cab, so I could ask them about this place. And I was very persistent, and I probably had to go around the block four, five, six times, but I didn't want to give up. And finally, this very distinguished-looking gentleman gets in the cab. And long story short, because I've said it before on the radio, it turned out he is Neil. I asked him who he was. He said he's Neil Miller, and he's the guy who proved that biofeedback worked. And I said to him, half joking but half serious, I said, I am not letting you out of this cab until you give me a job. And that was critical. He laughed, fortunately. He knew I was joking, fortunately. He said, write me a letter. I came home that night. I knew I had to show that I was really responsible. I was not just another average cabbie. And I indeed got a job there, which catapulted me into my Berkeley PhD program. So assertiveness, while not being outrageous, assertiveness really does, within limits, pay is the lesson there. I'll give out the phone number again.
Well, yeah, but I have to say, in today's world, that could, you knew you were joking, he knew you were joking, that could have been interpreted as a threat.
Not the way I said it. No. I'm not letting you out of this cabin, you'll give me a job. And I, with a laugh in my face. No, there's no way he would have thought that was a threat. By the way, there was no more pipsqueaky-looking guy than me.
Yeah, he's sitting behind you.
All right. Barbara, you don't need to always find a counterpoint. Next, I'll give out the phone number, though. If you want to tell your signature moment or three in your work history, or you'd like a workover, you've got a work-related problem, and you'd like our help, for you feel free to call here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. My next memory of my work life was, it shows you how little college prepares you for the real world. Now, I've graduated from college, and I became at some point a drug counselor, and they liked my work in this drug program, and then they named me the supervisor. And I had never been a boss before, but I just knew I was the boss. So I decided that the way you're supposed to be a boss is to boss people around. And I got fired in 2 days because I was bossing everybody around. So, you know, college is about liberal arts. It ain't necessarily about practicalities.
True.
Next. Much later now, I was a visiting professor at UC Davis, and the chair of the department was showing me around the campus. And in the course of discussion, I just happened to offhandedly mention, we're making small talk, I say, I really like New Yorkers because they're straight shooters. I was not rehired. And I believe, and I'm not sure about this, it's now a couple of decades, 3 decades ago, so I'm not exactly clear about it, but he turns out to be a very urbane, Midwesterner, salt, very polite and everything, and tactful. And my saying that I like New straight shooting New Yorkers, it was an indictment of tact and the Midwestern way of being. So I learned about how careful you have to be in what you say. And if that was true back in 85, which was when that was, it is quintuply true in 2018, 19, now 19, when, you know, I feel like everybody's on a hair trigger, just waiting to call you, you know, an ist of some sort. So that UC Davis thing was my first introduction to the importance of being extraordinarily careful in the workplace and what you say. Next, as a career counselor, I was shocked. And I mean, I don't mean to sound sanctimonious, but it's only the truth when I think about a moment that I really remember of how much dishonesty exists in job seekers. And one particular incident, and this is not the only one, but one that really stands out, is this woman who had gotten fired from her last two or three jobs. She had a substance abuse problem. She was not that bright. She was not that hardworking. She was a real pain. And this was long ago, before I was able to select clients, and so I was grateful to get clients. But she admitted to me that because she couldn't get a good reference from her boss, she had her boyfriend pretend to be her boss and use that as her reference. And
ooh.
That started me down the pen, and that was just one of, I can't tell you, and so that's why employers now go through, it's one of the reasons employers go through 3, 4, 5 rounds of interviews, hire background checking services that check, you know, resume veracity and college transcript veracity. That was a signature sad moment. I've mentioned mainly happy moments. That was a signature sad moment in my work as a career counselor. Another happy moment was I had wanted, this time I'd already been on the radio for a couple of decades, and I became addicted to the microphone and feeling that I do know what I'm doing in front of a microphone. But I decided, even though I have a great face for radio, that I thought it would be fun. I'm a PBS person, an NPR type person. I thought would be the most cool thing in the world would be to do a PBS pledge drive special, you know, those one-man shows they have. Mm-hmm. So I go to PBS, and we had one guy who we knew in Florida, you know, and I asked him, is there any way that I could do something called 8 Keys to a Better Work Life or something like that? And he laughed at me. He said, it's all about the money. I said, this is public TV. What do you mean it's all about the money? So I had a client who was very high up at Monster.com. And I called him and I told him that I may have the chance to do a PBS pledge drive special, but it requires $200,000, quote, underwriting. It's like commercials. $200,000 underwriting for Monster. But in life, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. Timing is everything. This was when Monster.com was at its peak. It was the dominant force in online job seeking. $200,000 for them, they wiped their noses with $200,000. They wrote me a check for $200,000, and all of a sudden, voila, I now do a one-man show, including on KQED nationwide, 8 Keys to a Better Work Life. The lesson there, unfortunately, it makes me sad that even in nonprofit worlds, money talks. Money talks.
Money always talks.
It's sad, but it's true. Money talks. And the final one I want to mention, I really want to prioritize the listeners, but I had written a book called How to Get Your Child a Private School Education in a Public School, and it was published by a small publisher, Acropolis Books in Washington, D.C., and it sold crappy, about 5,000 copies or whatever. But I was fortunate eventually to get to write a book that I thought was a niche book called Cool Careers for Dummies. But that was those Yellow and Black Dummies books, and it's owned by John Wiley and Son. That taught me the power of brands. That book sold 125,000 copies because, not that the book was better than my previous book. We live in a society where people will spend $500 on $20 shoes. They did a study recently where they showed that shoes from Payless, shoe stores, and then they put a $500 price tag, calling it Jimmy Choo or whatever it was, and these people were buying these $500 shoes.
Wow.
Humankind is silly. We pay for a label sewn onto your jeans that, you know, a $20 pair of jeans, and people spend $200, $300, $500 for jeans. So, but it showed me the power of the branding thing. And so those are some of my most memorable moments regarding career. I'll give out the phone number again. If you have either want to tell a work life story that would be instructive to all of us, or you have a work-life problem that you would like Barbara and or me to try to help you with, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You've been pretty quiet during my presentation of these. Anything you want to say, or do you want to move to the next segment?
I think I'd love to hear from listeners.
I couldn't do more than give out the phone number. In preparation for today's show, I had a feeling this topic wasn't going to go all the way through the hour. I wrote a little essay that I would like to read to you with a very powerful career lesson, I believe. And I don't want to go, the essay will take about 5 minutes for me to read, but I'd like you to feel free to interrupt, Barbara, and either, as usual, disagree, amplify, say amen, whatever. Okay?
Okay.
I call it Moving Forward, a Lesson from Holocaust Survivors. I'm the child of two Holocaust survivors. And so I grew up knowing about 24 other survivors in addition to my parents. And because I lived at home through my college years, I got to observe them not just when I was a kid, but when I was a young adult, till I was like 23 when I moved out of my parents' house. And some of those Holocaust survivors, they managed to triumph over those years of Holocaust tortures, their loss of their family, their being dumped in the Bronx without a penny to their name, no English, no education, no friends. But other survivors remained mired in sadness and suspicion of everybody. And I have no doubt that their individual character and their early upbringing had an effect on them. But it also seemed clear to me, at least, that the survivors that spent a lot of time looking backward, that is, you know, talking about the Holocaust, attending Holocaust remembrances, joining Holocaust survivor discussion groups, trying to process the Holocaust experiences in individual therapy, on average, they were sadder. The ones, including both of my parents, who were able to move on and live pretty darn full work lives, social lives too, and having good relationships with their kids and with their friends, they spent little time on that. Yeah, they believed that it was important to, you know, they always use the term, never forget about the Holocaust, of course, but they spent very little time on that. Rather, they focused on moving forward. And in my dad's case, that was working in a factory in Harlem and saving up so he could move my mom and my sister and me from the Bronx tenement that was next to the elevated train that roared 24/7 to the apartment in blue-collar Flushing, Queens, where I spent most of my childhood. And then he had a little bit of he worked 7 days a week, but he had a little spare time. He still, you know, he wasn't like he was depressed thinking about the Holocaust. He was an avid gardener, and he was a cartoonist. My mom, she focused on being a great homemaker. She, not a great cook, but she spent a lot of time cooking and shopping and cleaning and throwing parties. She was good at that. And looking, she always looked great, like you, Barbara. She, you know, she came out of bed with her makeup on. Her clothes were great, jewelry, hair, and all that. And I sense that both my mom and my dad lived the life that they wanted to live, not being unduly burdened by their horrific Holocaust past because they didn't spend their life looking backward. Now, of course, I'm giving you just impressionistic reactions. Other than my parents, I really don't know what those other Holocaust survivors were really like behind closed doors. But I'm more confident in being able to say that based on my work with now 5,500 career and personal coaching clients that I've had now over 30 years, that the more time in sessions that I allow, let alone encourage, clients to revisit their past iniquities, what their parents did to them, what their sibling did to them, what their spouse did to them, what the society did to them, what their boss did to them, the less likely they are to move forward and the more likely they are to remain sad, a victim, and importantly, the more likely they are to externalize responsibility for their current lack of a good career and a good personal life. So, in my initial session with my career and personal coaching clients, I usually do start by inviting them to take a few minutes to tell me about their life's most influential experiences, like I was doing today. And I do indeed try to show empathy, and I do feel very empathy for the crap that's happened to them in their life. But after that, and that's usually just a few minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, I don't know, whatever, I usually move to helping them right to developing a plan for moving forward. And if the client then at that point or a little later on in the session or later session brings up some past ill treatment or a personal failure, I usually try to quickly move the discussion back forwards. Like, for example, I might say, I, of course, understand how painful that must have been. Is there a lesson to be learned from that that'll help you take the next step forward? Or I might say something like, even if my parents beat me nightly with a stick, or even if I were an axe murderer, I believe that the path to greater success and happiness is in identifying my next steps forward. What do you think? And then usually they agree. And if not, I will listen patiently, empathically to their re-explanation of that source of their malaise that may have occurred last year or 30 years ago. But I move things forward as soon as I can. Now, I don't have the hubris to assert that every person, nor every helping professional like a psychologist or career counselor, I don't believe necessarily that every one of them should discourage extensive processing of their ill treatment as a child or their boss or whatever. I can say only that especially for people who've already done a fair amount of what I call retrospective reflection, I'd be wary of more what they call processing. It may be a cliche, but at least in my practice and in my own life, to be honest, I find that people are most likely have lives improved by identifying, yeah, and I hate this because it is a cliche, simply identifying the next baby steps forward and almost forcing themselves to take that next step forward, because objects in motion tend to stay in motion and objects at rest tend to stay at rest. Barbara Nemco, any reactions to that?
I think that's a really important point. I think wallowing in your own misery gets you no place except more miserable. And you distract yourself by doing something productive. You don't distract yourself by going drinking or taking drugs. That's not the way to do it. But do something that has some meaning for you, for other people, and your whole mood and outlook about the world can change.
I mean, I really am wanting to avoid being blanket in, I don't like black and white thinking. I am well aware that there are some people, not everybody is equally resilient. There are some people who simply need a longer grieving process, processing process, or who have mental illness. You know, even if it's garden variety depression, makes it darn hard to move forward. I'm not saying everybody can push through everything, but all things equal, it's sure as hell worth trying rather than revisiting for the umpteenth time what your boss did to you or your mother did to you or the evil society, you know, has wreaked upon you, to try to say, okay, if I were healthy psychologically, what would be the most, what would the wise woman within me, the wise man within me, what would be my goal and what would be my little, not scary, baby steps toward getting there? And that normally is certainly a no-risk activity. And I like Barbara's statement.
I'm not sure you can guarantee that it's not going to be scary. I think it may be scary.
Well,
but it's pretty scary to sit around and just continue to make yourself unhappy.
And one thing I liked what you said, you mentioned in passing, focusing on somebody else. If you've been pretty inert, and again, this is a cliche, I don't mean to sound like Father Nemco here, but when people are self-absorbed, when they're in therapy, therapy is all about them, and they wrap themselves into narcissism and self-absorption and reflection on all the crap that happened to them back in high school, as Neil Simon said in his song. Whereas if you make yourself, devote yourself to even volunteering, whether it be in a hospital or a political cause you believe in or helping a relative who's in trouble, the more you focus on other people, the less your problems seem, and that can be a first baby step. Going looking for a job may be too scary or too hard, but it isn't quite as hard to hug a baby in a new baby clinic or a doggy in a humane society, a rescue. And so, for what it's worth, that's what I think. I want to now, I'm going to give out the phone number again. If you want to work over, you've got a work problem, Barbara Nemco and Martin Nemco are here to help you. That's us. We've been doing it now for almost 30 years and feel like we've got a little bit of expertise to share. And it's our pro bono work. And so if you have a work problem, you can call right now. Lines are available, which is not usually the case. Phone number 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Barb, you'll remember that a few weeks ago we had you on the show, and I had put together what I call stocking stuffers. Little quick tips that are helpful in your job, and I did some of them, but we didn't get to all of them.
Well, and stuff away.
No, I don't have to. Now the phone suddenly, I think when I gave people permission to say that the you know, lines are available, all of a sudden they're ringing away here.
Okay, well then let's answer them.
Yeah, I think I need another moment. Do we need another moment? We got ready to put the calls on the line? Okay, cool. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's and Barbara Nemco, of course. It's your turn on the air. How can we help you?
Hi, yeah, my name is John. I used to work for a small, like, mom and pop company, and I ended up leaving them due to no room for progression, I guess, in the position that I was in.
Uh-huh.
And I ended up kind of walking out on them, but they never gave me a last paycheck. I'm wondering, is that something I should ever be concerned about?
Well, certainly you have a right to a last pay. Why wouldn't you? I mean, it would seem logical that you should be concerned about that. Why wouldn't you be concerned about that? Or you didn't give notice? Is that it? You just walked out and didn't give him any notice? Is that it?
Yeah, I really didn't. I mean, I've been working there for about 3 years. I'd walked in meeting and for like a pay raise and see what I could do now to.
You've cut out.
So to the company.
You're on a cell and you're kind of cutting out. So I'm going to let you hang up and I'm going to give you the answer off the air what I would do. If it's possible, I would probably go in and make a mea culpa, saying, you know, I was angry that, you know, I had asked for a raise or whatever and you kept blowing me off and in frustration I left. I probably should have given you notice and I feel bad about that. On the other hand, there was 2 weeks that I worked and did not get paid, and I'm wondering if you, it feels ethical that I ask not to get any severance pay or anything, but that you pay me for those 2 weeks. And I would probably, you know, make that little apology. If they're tough, they could say, no, you walked out, you left us in a lurch, you cost us a fortune, blah, blah, blah. They could go that route. But depending upon how decent human beings they are, by being statesmanlike, by the way, which is one of my favorite words in the context of almost everything, job seekers especially, rather than being salesmen. That's a new phrase I like. Be a statesman, not a salesman, when you're a job seeker. That's going to gain trust so much more, make you more hireable. But in any case, if you walk in and try to make an appointment, be respectful. If you know what time their business is slow, go in when it's slow. Perhaps even invite them and say, can I take you out for coffee? We ended on a bad note. I'm wondering if we could chat. And then start with the apology. There's no guarantees in life, but I think that's worth doing. You know, don't worry about the egg on your face. You know, we all make bigger mistakes than that. So own up to it a little bit and see if you can invoke in them their best selves. And that's my best shot. Barbara, anything you want to say about that?
No, I agree. I think you should ask.
Yeah.
Maybe,
you know,
they overlooked it. Maybe they were angry at the time and then forgot about it.
I love that phrase that at the Harvard orientation for new students, they say one of the secrets of success at Harvard is ask for what you want, and when they say no, ask somebody else. So it never hurts to ask, certainly, as long as it's ethical, ask. And my shy clients, they're very often afraid to ask their network, let alone a strange potential employer, for a job. Because they're embarrassed, they feel like they're imposing or whatever. But I really believe that as long as you're ethical and you're not overselling, if you're saying, here's what I bring to the table and here are my gaps, you know, here's what I'm not good at. It's like, for example, I have a client now who is very interested in getting in the field of stopping money laundering. He's got some expertise. But he's got some gaps where he doesn't have all the skills really needed. And I urged him, you know, you can't just apply for a job if you've got big gaps. You're probably not going to get it. There aren't that many jobs, you know, countering money laundering anyway. But you're probably not going to be the winning candidate if it's openly advertised, because there'll be like dozens of people who have most of the or all the requirements. But instead, you know, identify 10 people with the potential power to hire you. Write them, tell them what you bring to the table, its strengths, but acknowledge your weaknesses and say, am I delusional to think that I could make the transition into this career? That's being a statesman. It's not being a salesman. Anyway, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. How can we help you?
Hello, Barbara. Hello, Marty. I was wondering, I have been owning my own business now for the last 15 years, mm-hmm. and it's in the fitness realm. I do work now mostly with seniors. Mm. I've been looking at the idea of starting a new fitness program and taking it out into the world, and I just can't take that step to actually do it. And I keep finding myself looking at different ways and marketing it. I haven't even got to that point. I keep saying to myself, why do it? What is it that you want to get from doing this program? And I keep coming back to that it will help people, but I don't know if that's enough.
Are you afraid? You know, let's look at the sources of resistance. Do any of the following or any of the following operative? Feeling it's going to put a lot, you're going to put a lot of time in and effort, and it's not going to succeed. It's not that good a program. There's too much competition. You don't need the money. You know, you're just too tired to do it. Any of those feel like they're the sources of resistance to your going out and doing it?
When I look at the fear, I always look at it as if, is it going to be good enough? Will it be what my expectations, will the people that are receiving, will their expectations be met with what it is that I'm giving?
All right, so let's be specific. Tell me, say I'm a potential client. Let's say I am an assisted living facility. I'm Ross Moore, and I'm in charge of booking groups or individual, senior, whatever it is you're going to be doing. Pitch to me why, without any lying or exaggeration, tell me why your program is worthy. It doesn't have to be the best in the world, but why is it worthy?
Well, I myself am aging myself, so I'm starting to feel the changes, that happen not only on a daily basis, but on a monthly basis. And, and as the years are rolling by, the body's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to have a longer shelf life, so my body will be able to give me the quality of life that I want in 10 years down the track or 20 years down the track.
I'm going to interrupt you. All I'm hearing is about you. What I need you here to say is people who are in their 60s and 70s see their bodies changing. And I have adapted a program that incorporates the best of this program and this program and this program. And as a result, here is my 10-step program that I'm going to have. And here is why it would work well. And because I'm of that age, I can particularly relate. Can you see how that's a stronger pitch?
Marty, that's so much better. That is so much better.
So your homework assignment is to practice, is to create a version of that for your privacy, to say it to you, write it out. Say it to yourself, not memorize it. Say it to your best friend and beg for honest feedback. Barbara, what?
Can I have one more question, though?
I want Barbara, first of all, wait, hold on. Barbara, do you have any...
No, I can't hear her question.
Okay, go ahead. Please ask your question.
So the other question I've been wrestling with is why not just go and take somebody else's program and become part of their system and become one of their master trainers?
Why not? Right.
Well, that's what I'm struggling with.
It's a good
with.
Answer. Why? No. When you're scared of the whole damn thing, you don't eat an elephant all at once. You eat it a bite at a time. So why don't you take a baby step, find the program that serves seniors, whether it's Curves or whatever, that you believe in, and start there. And that will make you say, you know, great, I'm happy just working at Curves because I don't want to have to deal with the marketing and the bookkeeping and the finding a rental place and all the rest of it. Why not take the baby step and then decide whether you want to step back or step forward from there?
Okay.
So, Barbara Nemko, please, I want you to give you the last word. We only have a few seconds left. Barbara, your thoughts?
Well, I wonder what would happen if you tried and failed, and what are the potential risks if you tried and succeeded?
Yeah.
Are there risks? I mean, Barbara asked a great question. What's your answer?
The risk is just putting the time in. Marty, it's really Barbara finding the time to be able to put the program together and to be able to take
don't
it out.
Don't do that yet. No, try a small little part-time job for 10 hours a week working at the place that does this kind of thing where it's a largely senior audience that you most believe in is ethical. You learn a lot from the process as well. There you have minimum time commitment, no money commitment, and they're always looking for part-timers. Does that make sense?
Marty, I already do that. I have my own facility. I already have hundreds of hours of work every month. That
good.
I see
okay.
People
then we've got
facilities.
To end. Then your homework assignment is to simply create that pitch for your own project,
okay.
For your own, and then you may decide to scrap it. But it's a low risk shoestring exercise that I want you to do. And the show is over, so I have to just thank you very
thank
much for
you.
Calling.
Thank
okay.
you, both of you.
Great.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Good
and,
luck.
And that is Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko for this week. My thanks to my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, at a recent Mensa convention, there was a session I thought would be terrible, boring, on what it's like to be a professional oboist. But it was, pardon the pun, it blew me away. So I invited her, her name is Lana Lee, to come on the show. And so until next Thursday, this is Marty Nemko for Barbara Nemko, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archives of Dr. Marty Nemko's articles, information on his 11 books, including his new one, Careers for Dummies, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemko.com. That's MartyNemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Thursday evening at 7 for Work with Marty Nemko right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.